Welcome, dear listeners, to this week's episode of Afternoon Satsang. We're joining you after that beautiful Qawwali which was performed in Swami's presence in the year 2000. Dear listeners, before that, you were listening to an interview with Mr. Cheema from the organization in Delhi. He was talking about the new initiative they are taking up in reaching out Swami's message to the corporate world. As always, this week, I'm here with you, Prem from Team Radio Sai, and with me is Arvind, and we are here to take you through this week's, or this fortnight's episode of Ramkatha Raswahini.
Shri Raghavam Dasharatatmajam Aprameyam Sitapatim Raghukulanmaya Ratnadipam Janu Bahum Aravinda Dalayataksham Ramam Nisha Vinashakaram Namami Namami
Wasn't that so beautiful? Just taking the name of the Lord brings such tranquility, such peace, such joy and such contentment in the heart. Prem, I was just, going back to the point where we had stopped the narrative of the beautiful and sweet nectarine story of Lord Rama. Lord Rama and his brother Lakshmana, along with the great sage Vishwamitra and his entire entourage of disciples, they are now headed towards Mithila in order to attend that grand yagna which King Janaka is performing. They are now traversing the forests and the plains and the different regions that come between these two kingdoms. It is a journey that is going to last several days. And on this journey, it is such a beautiful joy because whether they are unaware, whether they are aware or not, the disciples are accompanying the Lord. And the journey with the Lord is a totally different thing altogether. It can be compared, when we think of how Swami was when he visited the Bandipur forests or the Madhumalai forests. Just you, the Lord and nature and nothing else. Often they say that being with the Lord is the greatest joy. The next greatest joy is being with nature. Imagine being with the Lord in nature. That is the joy that the disciples of Vishwamitra and sage Vishwamitra enjoyed as they walked along with Rama towards Mithila. And when I was reading this, it felt so similar to Swami also. Because just like in this entourage, in Swami's entourage too, we would have people like Vishwamitra who are aware of Rama's divinity, who are wise, who are aware of the great opportunity that is being bestowed on them. At the same time, there would be a lot number of people, many of us who, like the disciples of Vishwamitra, would be unaware of the great chance that is being, you know, bestowed on us. We enjoy it, no doubt. It is great fun. It is wonderful to accompany Swami on a trip in the forest. We are mesmerized. There is something magical about Swami. But do we realize the magnificent import of being with the Lord in Prakriti? But that is the beauty of Swami's presence. Whether we realize it or we don't, we are benefited by it and we share in that magic. We are enthralled with that magic.
You know, it doesn't end surprising you how many little and very subtle lessons are there throughout the Ramayana. Mm. As you said, you know, we are lucky to draw parallels between what we read in the Ramayana and what we've lived with Swami. But even the narrative itself, you know, when you look at the Ramakatha Rasavahini as Swami has written it, you go through the other discourses where Swami has spoken about Ramayana. There are endless amount of details and each of those details give such beautiful messages. We were talking about how Vishwamitra leaves that Siddhashrama and moves out. And he says, I'm not going to come back after Mithila. I'm just moving ahead.
Absolute detachment. Malayas.
You know, there Swami describes the scene. He says that citizens of that place start crying. And then as Vishwamitra and all the other, ashramites along with Rama and Lakshmana head towards Mithila, Swami says they are being followed by the wild animals in the forest. Swami says that even they are not able to take the fact that Vishwamitra is not going to come back. You know, you look at it, Swami explains this so beautifully. This Vishwamitra, who is nobody but that King Kaushika, who was after that cow. You know, this whole journey started for him when he wanted to possess that cow, when he wanted to say that, I want this to be mine.
Hmm.
Being the king, I have every right over this animal. And that king, you know, has traveled all this, the entire journey he has taken. He's become a Brahmarishi. And today when he says, I'm going to leave this land and go, the entire animal kingdom wants to follow him. He says that we belong to you, please don't leave us behind.
In fact, Swami writes that Vishwamitra turns to them and tells, you know, that my love for you, the special place that you occupy in my heart will always be there. But there is a reason why you have been kept where you have been kept. You will not be able to reside in the place that I'm going, which is civilization, which is human habitation. And therefore, it is safe, it is good that you remain in the forest. Know for sure that your place in my heart is permanent. He assuages their sorrows and then he prays to them to stay back in the forest. And that is how they proceed ahead after leaving that forest.
Right. And all through that journey, there's so many little stories. That's what we also mentioned the last time. The lot of the upakathas which come in Ramayana, especially in the Balakanda, happen in that journey, where Vishwamitra reveals a lot of stories to Rama and Lakshmana.
And in fact, if we go through each of those stories, it will take us as much time as it took Rama and Lakshmana to get to the kingdom of Mithila, because those many stories are there. You know, Prem, what I felt was reading some of the stories, some of them Swami has spoken later in his discourses, giving us the inner meaning, the significance, and we are able to make sense. Otherwise, these stories just remain as stories. There are some other stories which I am sure if we meditate upon, think about, they are metaphors and they carry great meaning. But I think in our satsang, we shall stick to those stories for which Swami has given us meanings and interpretations, or stories for which we have been inspired in our hearts with what possibly could be their inner significance. Because without that, a story just remains certain names, certain incidents which are possibly difficult to remember. So I feel that we should stick to these kind of stories for which we have been inspired with meanings, or for which Swami has directly given what is the inner significance.
And stories which Swami has often repeated as the important stories which come in this part of the Ramayana. And one of the most important ones, and the ones which is very elaborately discussed there, is the story of how Ganges was brought down to the earth. Because as the journey progresses, they are, pitching tent on the banks of River Ganges. And that's when Rama asks Vishwamitra, do tell us the story of how this holy river came to be part of, you know, the earthly plane. And that's when Vishwamitra starts the story.
Yes. And, this is something very special that we follow in our Bharatiya tradition. It is called Stala Mahatyam, or the significance of the particular place. It is considered to be great and holy and wonderful if you are able to hear the story in the place of its occurrence. Just today morning, you know, one of our colleagues is getting married. So it is being held in the Patha Mandiram. I was there for a brief interval. And over there, when we went to the Patha Mandiram, next to it is the first, you know, the place where Swami did bhajan from 1945 to 1950. We have covered that in our Satyam Shyam Sundaram series. Now there I was speaking to two or three of my classmates, and I was telling them, do you know that this is the place that Swami rested, Swami did bhajans? And as I was describing the stories and the experiences of Swami in the Patha Mandiram, the thrill on their face was entirely different. Trust me, Prem, I have narrated these incidents and episodes several occasions, apart from in the radio satsang here. Every time it does move the people, but the kind of impact it was having on the people there when I was narrating on these three people, it was almost spellbinding. And I feel that is the magic of the place. Narrating the story of Swami's childhood in the place where he spent his childhood builds some kind of magic which you just cannot create anywhere else. It's almost like that. And that is called Stala Mahatyam, Stala Prabhavam. And that was the reason why this story gains even more significance, because it was being narrated on the banks of River Ganga, and the story is about River Ganga. In fact, Vishwamitra tells Rama that, Rama, do you know that your ancestors, your great family is responsible for having brought down Ganga?
No, even before we go into that story, just reminded of what one of our visiting faculty once shared with us, you know. Mm. This person is an expert in water treatment.
Mm.
He has done at least 3 or 4 theses in that, and he has guided not less than 10-20 students who have done this one in river treatment, river water treatment, and rejuvenation and all that. If I'm not wrong, he was one Dr. Bhargava from a university somewhere in the north, a very, very accomplished scientist. And he was telling that he has almost tested every water of every river in the world
in the world.
He said every river, every famous river I've tested.
Like the Nile, Amazon.
Right, everything, you know, Thames and every other big river which we all know today.
Hmm.
So then one of the students asked him, sir, what is so special about the Ganga? You know, we give it such an important place. What is so special about the Ganga? He said, see, philosophically and mythologically, there are many stories which go with it. But I can tell you scientifically why the Ganga is very special.
Uh-huh.
He was saying that every river has a certain property to purify itself, or, you know, kind of
cleanse
itself. And that is measured in how many kilometers of that riverfront. After how many kilometers of the riverfront, you find pure water after the riverfront has been polluted. Like, suppose you have an industrial exit into the river.
Mm.
It is said that after a certain kilometers, the river water automatically purifies itself. It has the ability to take in, you know, the whatever is the filth which is put in it, and to purify itself. And he said, no river in the world has that ability as much as Ganga has.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, it's such a sad thing that, you know, we don't recognize it. And just
we dump even more.
Right, you know, a little bit of manipulation and deciding that where you can have your other things going into the river. It's just a little bit of planning that can actually revive that whole river. But he was saying that it's a very, very special property of the river, and that is why it also has medicinal properties. That is why even a dip in the Ganga can, even in a medical or physical level, benefit you a lot.
Wow, that's amazing to hear. And this is not the first time we see such things, Prem, where things that are mentioned in the Vedas, in the scriptures, it's just that the time has not yet come. When the time comes, you discover that it was already there. So many things, we are now going back to the roots and discovering. I mean, we see the case of the United States trying to patent things which are present in the Ayurveda.
Right.
I mean, these are all... and now we give importance. Just because, you know, an outsider is giving importance, we start giving importance to these ancient... to this ancient wisdom. So too in the case of Ganga. And, well, you told the scientific reasoning and rationale behind. The story itself is very, very impressive. There was this ruler, Emperor Sagara of Ayodhya. And you know, I'll just brief, go through the story a little quickly. He had two wives. Actually, he had one wife by name Keshini. And since he couldn't get any progeny from Keshini, with Keshini's permission, just like Emperor Dasharatha did with Kausalya's permission, he takes permission of the Queen Keshini and marries a second queen called Sumati. And he doesn't get progeny from both the queens. And that is when, you know, after years and which turn into decades, the king Sagara, Emperor Sagara, feels that he possibly is not blessed to have children. He gives up all hope, and when he's on the verge of despair, that is when sage Bhrigu comes to him and assures him that you don't worry, you will have sons. He gives special blessings. You know, again in this, there's that important lesson to show that, you know, the blessings of elders is so important. In what looked like a hopeless case of having no progeny, the emperor is able to get progeny simply by the blessings of sage Bhrigu. So, for a child listening to the story, unknown to itself, the child gets the feeling that, you know what, if I treat my elders with respect and regard, I will be benefited. It might appear like a selfish way to inculcate, but that is the truth. And that is what actually happens. The elder may not, like a sage, the elder may not be a sage, but an elder definitely is a medium and instrument for the grace of God to flow. Mm-hmm. And that is what happened here. In fact, Bhrigu asks both the queens, would you like one supremely powerful, supremely intelligent and, you know, very, very good son, or do you want multiple sons? While Keshini opts for the first option, that is, let me get one super strong, super intelligent son, Sumati seeks multiple sons, and that's what happens. Within a few years, Sumati has hundreds of children, while Keshini has one son by the name Ashwamanja. Ashwamanja turns out to be a very strong person and a very, very intelligent person, but he goes the wrong way. He uses his intelligence and strength to torment and trouble others, because of which King Sagara banishes him from the kingdom.
Interestingly, the way Swami writes it, you know, he would get delight in going to the riverbed with all his other co-brothers, you know, the children of Sumati.
Hmm.
And just for the fun of it, he would just pick them up and throw them in the water.
Hmm.
And he had drowned so many of his brothers in that manner.
And, you know, this goes to show again that though physical prowess and mental acumen and mental prowess is appreciated, people look up to it, if it is not used for others' benefit, people are ready to even do away, sacrifice physical prowess and mental. They say, we don't want intelligent people, we don't want strong people, if you don't use it for good. That is a powerful message that is embedded here. Because a person who is so intelligent, a person who is so strong, is just banished away into the forests where his strength and intelligence is of no use. So that is what happens. In the meanwhile, Ashwamanja, you know, he carries on with his life in the forest, and he gets a son by name Amshumanta. And Amshumanta happens to be a very virtuous and noble child. If you see our scriptures, it is filled with so many such apparent discrepancies, you know, which goes against genetics. You see demons giving birth to virtuous children. You see saints, you see very noble people giving birth to children who become demons. So, you know, this kind of virtue and vice, though to some extent is modified by the environment in which the child grows, it shows that there is something beyond genetics that decides parenthood, or that decides the lineage and children. And that is where the soul comes in. You know, people often think a child is a body and a mind, but a child is a soul. Because while you see the mind and the body being very similar between parents and children, the soul and virtues or vices differ so much. How can you otherwise explain Hiranyakashipu, a demon in every sense, giving birth to Prahallada, who is almost God incarnate on earth? So that really sets us thinking into, you know, how important it is to get a pious soul, not just a healthy body and a good mind.
You know, that's the beauty. For us, if we look at Hiranyakashipu, we say he was so lucky to get a son like Prahlada. But from his point of view, he was actually cursing his fate to have got a son like Prahlada, because he said, the entire kingdom is worshipping me as king, but my own son says that Vishnu is the only Lord. So if you look at it from Hiranyakashipu's point of view, he actually got a bad son. So in a sense, all these people, then that is why, you know, going back to that thing of getting the blessings of elders, it is not merely getting the boon of children, not merely getting the boon of having a prosperous life. There is so much to life which goes beyond words and beyond understanding. And that is why if you look at even the Indian tradition, you know, you said you went for a wedding this morning, the way the Indian wedding is performed, for that matter, any wedding is performed, why do we have this tradition of inviting so many people? You know, today we have gone to the thing of saying that whose wedding was more grander, whose menu was more exhaustive.
Exotic, huh?
You know, it goes to that, but the idea, the very basic idea of that is, you know, here is a couple who is starting a new journey. You want as many blessings as you can get. And you get it by calling people and telling them that you are important for this event. And all the hospitality you give is to show that importance to the guests who come, and so that those guests wholeheartedly bless this couple, because it is quite a rocky journey. It's not easy, and you have so many, you know, if you look at it, every lineage which Swami speaks about here, Swami's, any problem, he kind of sources it to 3-4 generations before.
Exactly.
And you know, that is how important each journey of a, you know, married couple is.
And you know, Prem, coming to the other point which I was saying about not only viewing your child in the terms of body and the mind, but also the soul, it makes a huge difference in a practical sense also. I was recently speaking to an alumnus from our university, an alumnus who is, you know, way senior to us, in his 50s. He is not in India right now. But, you know, whatever destiny has been such, that he got children after a long time.
Okay.
And when he got children, they were sweet, sweet children, sweet daughters, and I think they were twins. I'm not remembering now whether, basically two children. I don't know if they're twins. But within 2 years of their birth, he got to know that they're autistic.
Okay.
So because of that, they're very sweet children, but, you know, it's like almost, normally you will consider it like, oh God, how do I, you know, why me? But he considers it like a great blessing in his life. And it's not just for a show. He sincerely believes, and when you see him speaking about his children, you will wonder whether sages have been born to him, because that is how he addresses them. He says, you know what, when you read all our scriptures, when they speak of these, you know, we have many children who are like born, Jivan Mukta, they were born wise, they had some purpose to achieve, and they are born for 10 years, they achieve it and they are gone. We have read so many like that, who have a halo around their head even at birth. He says, How do we distinguish such children as in our scriptures? Though they describe as a halo around the head, you actually don't see a halo. It's just that they're absolutely detached from the world. They're attached to nothing of the world because they're so deeply immersed in their own inner being. That is how exactly my children are. Swami has blessed me so abundantly that he has given me a chance to serve two yogis. What else can be greater fulfillment in my life? And even as he says this, he has tears of joy in his eyes, which show you for sure that this is not some act that he's putting on or some dialogue that he's stating. He sincerely believes in that. And he's able to do it because he's able to see beyond the body and mind of his children and look at them as souls. And it makes all the difference. It makes a difference between considering somebody as disabled vis-a-vis considering somebody as a yogi and a special blessing that you have got to associate with them.
And I think in a sense it also shows one's selflessness. Because very often we look at our children as people who are going to take care of us in the future. And that is why it's a disappointment when you get a child whom you will have to take care all your life. You know, the idea that I'm going to take care of him for 20, 25 years and I'm not going to get anything in return at the end of it. And the security and that protection which you
expect,
you know, seek in your old age from your children, you're not going to get it. But to feel that, you know, to give itself is such a great opportunity which has been given to me, it really shows how selfless that person is.
coming back to the story, what happens is Sagara is very happy with Amshumanta, who is his grandson, and Sagara finally feels that here is a worthy successor, because Amshumanta is a paragon of all virtues. He has all the strength, he has all the mental capabilities, he is wonderful and a perfect ruler. That's what Sagara feels, and therefore Sagara now feels that it is time ripe for an Ashwamedha Yajna. An Ashwamedha Yajna, if we describe the theory of it, it is just like this. Basically, you do a fire sacrifice in at the end of which there is a horse that is let loose.
Right.
And then it's a rule that wherever the horse goes, whichever kingdom it wanders into, that belongs to you. If that is not to happen, then the ruler of that kingdom better wage a war, a fight with you and defeat you. Otherwise, his kingdom will be won over by the person who is performing an Ashwamedha Yajna. That is why only a select few would perform the Ashwamedha Yajna, because it's not enough if you just have a horse and some sages. You also need the might, the army might, to win over anybody who might stop the horse from wandering into their territory. So it is only a king after reaching certain prowess and having allies and having fame, name, riches, everything, then he performs the Ashwamedha Yajna to become the overlord of the entire earth. That is how it is done. At the end of this, at the end of that, all the kingdoms in which the horse has roamed gets annexed into this kingdom and becomes one large country. And the horse comes back and the horse is also sacrificed at the yajna, at the ceremonial pit. That is the Ashwamedha Yajna which Sagara also undertook to perform.
And you know, interestingly, if you look at it, many of these kings, later we will come, even Rama, when he's coronated, he performs an Ashwamedha Yajna. And we would see references to that even done by the Pandavas.
Yes, in the Mahabharata.
Right. You know, there is a...
Arjuna actually follows the horse.
Exactly. You know, there is a little difference in this, in the sense of not... It is not done in the idea of conquering a foreign land.
Hmm.
A king who has attained a certain stature, as you said, of fame and credibility, he says that I am the overlord. You are still allowed to rule your country. The country is still yours. I am allowed to be the overlord. In the sense, I have the right now to come and correct you if I feel that you are not administrating or taking care of your citizens in the manner you should be doing it. So a kind of a moral authority is what people like Rama and all did it for. It was not a sense of, you know, greed or trying to conquer or
exactly.
Annex.
It's almost like in India now we have a central government with state governments.
Exactly.
So the central government is at the national level, you have the prime minister and his cabinet. Yes, you have multiple chief ministers with their cabinet, but all of them are subservient to the prime minister.
Exactly. So it is more of a sense of bringing a central authority who will oversee the dispensation of justice in the various kingdoms.
And as we stated in the beginning, all these are very metaphorical. In fact, if you go to some Wikipedia page or somewhere and see Ashwamedha Yajna, they describe it in great physical detail. It may seem like, what is it that they are doing, you know, cutting the throat of a horse and this is bad. In fact, on many occasions, Swami has mentioned that when we mention animal sacrifice, when the scriptures mention animal sacrifice, it is a metaphor for sacrificing the animal qualities within us. It is misunderstanding that leads you to actually sacrifice an animal, a dumb animal. You don't get, the Lord is not pleased if you cut the neck of a goat. But if you cut the neck of timidity in you, or you cut the neck of anger within you, that is what pleases the Lord. So too, about the Ashwamedha Yajna, Swami says that horse is symbolic of the mind.
Some would often say that Ashwa
yes.
stands for the mind, because the nature of the horse is it can
fickle.
Never stand.
It is fickle.
Place,
it can right? never. In fact, that's why we see there are these many tongas or horse-drawn carriages that are still operating in some place in Mysore, and I have seen
right.
it. If you see the horse cart, the horse to its eyes they put some kind of blinders
right.
so that the horse can look only ahead. If they don't put those blinders, even why tonga horses, even these show jumping horses and other horses, they have a kind of blinder which makes them have the ability to look only forward, not to the sides, not behind, anywhere, because the horses are very, very fickle animals. They get very tempted and they get distracted. That's how it is said. So That is how the mind is. The mind is, unless it is focused, unless you have blinders called focus, you are not able to achieve or move forward. You will keep moving up, down, left, right, in all directions with distractions. And that is how Swami compares mind to a horse. Now, when you, letting go of the horse to wander freely and conquering all those lands where it wanders is symbolic to having the ability to fulfill everywhere that the mind roams. That is, whatever you desire, you are able to fulfill it. Achieving a level where you can fulfill whatever you desire. Imagine you have to be the most influential and most powerful and most wealthy person to have that ability to fulfill everything that the mind desires. That is to capture all the lands in which this horse called the mind roams about. But then, with that, the sacrifice is not considered complete. Because the sacrifice becomes complete and you become the overlord only when at the end of it, though you have the capacity to fulfill everything or capture everywhere that this horse goes, at the end of it you have to sacrifice the horse. You become the overlord only when you are able to sacrifice the mind and go beyond it. And that is what Swami means by saying, master the mind, be a mastermind. You have to be the master of the mind. You have to go beyond the mind. And then only will you be a true overlord. Then only will you have moral authority to correct all the other kings who are subservient to you.
You know, there's a beautiful analogy which Swami would give when people ask Swami how to control the mind.
Hmm.
You know, Swami would say, it's like a mother taking her child to the marketplace. Okay. And everything that the child sees, it's excited, you know. Everything which is open in the stalls, it goes around and says that I want this, I want this. So what the mother does is, Swami says, she just keeps walking. So here and there the child would stop near a stall and try to create a scene and cry and say that I want it and all that. So the mother just keeps walking. So after a few steps the child realizes it's not going to get what it's crying for. So it just stops the play and runs after the mother. Swami would say similarly, you know, very often your mind and your senses will be after some things. Just ignore it. You know, just ignore, don't give importance even to the craving. So automatically your mind will come back to the place. You know, in a sense what Swami is telling here about the Ashwamedha Yajna is letting the mind loose first of all. And if you just look at it very, very typically, let us say that there is one kingdom which is catching your horse and saying that I will not let it go. It is almost like there is one aspect of life where your mind has got conquered to, or your mind has become enslaved to that particular aspect of life. So you put in a lot of effort to get your mind out of that particular thing which the mind has got attached to. So you do this with different things in life, but at the end you say that, no, you are controlling the mind, but eventually you have to come to a state where you are annihilating the mind completely, which is what Swami would often call amanaska, the state where you are beyond the mind and without a mind.
And, you know, the horse has to finally return back to the kingdom where it started. This is a concept that has been glorified and sung about many times also. If you remember Swami Vivekananda's song, Chalo Man Jaye Ghariye Apne, O mind, let us return back to the home from which we have come. So all these find fulfillment and metaphorical meaning in this Ashwamedha Yajna. So Sagara performs the Ashwamedha Yajna and the Yajna is unable to get completed because the horse is missing. And nobody is able to find where the horse has gone. And King Sagara, you know, lashes out to all his children saying that, you know, you are hundreds of you, and you are not able to keep track of where the horse is. I mean, if you just look at all these dialogues in a metaphorical sense, it is so beautiful. I mean, what is the use of your strength? What is the use of your apparently noble birth, being born as children of a king, if you can't keep track of your own mind? You know, it is all so metaphorical, but from now on, we stop dilating on the metaphors and we continue the story so that people can interpret the metaphor in their own minds. So he says, you can't keep track of the horse, where is the horse? So the hundreds of sons set out in search for the horse. And they finally find this horse peacefully grazing in the hermitage of sage Kapila. Again, right. Another beautiful metaphor. The mind is at rest and at peace in the company of sages, you know.
And the beautiful thing is, it's not Kapila is lost in meditation. He's sitting there, It's just that the horse has gone and, you know, found a place near him, just drawn by that peace which
exactly
is surrounding.
It's not as if Kapila has captured the horse
or anything.
It's just that he has captured the mind, they say, right? You know, when you say somebody has captured your imagination or captured your mind, he or she need not call you to them. You will automatically get drawn. That is what has happened here. Drawn to the peace and beauty of the hermitage, the horse is there. But since these children, these hundreds of sons are angry and restless, they are unable to understand this. An angry mind is a sure shot way to doom, because it makes you lose your sense of discrimination. That is what Krishna says in that Bhagavad Gita shloka. That is what happens here also. They think that the sage has actually caught hold of the horse and the sage is challenging their might. So they start raising a ruckus and with their weapons come to attack the sage. Kapila is calm in his meditation. He just opens his eyes and looks at them, and in an instant they are all burned to ashes. And all the sons of Emperor Sagara are burnt to dust. And how do they come to know of this? Because Ashwamanja's son, Amshumanta, that is the grandson of King Saga, Emperor Sagara, comes in search of his uncles, and he gets to know what has happened here, and he goes back taking the horse, because Sage Kapila does not want the horse in any way, and he takes back the horse to King Emperor Sagara. And
right, and then the sacrifice comes to completion, you know, the thing goes and they conclude the sacrifice, but that is when he also breaks the news of all of Sagara's sons being killed in this untimely manner. And I think that is when they start this, because often, according to the Indian tradition, you're supposed to do those obsequies of any past soul by
the rites.
Right. You do it by, submersing the ashes, or what you call asti, of those people in a holy river.
Mm.
But the predicament they have here is there are hundreds of sons, and they believe the sin of going and inciting a sage as pure as Kapila was also a very, very immense
big sin. And multiple times it has been committed, because
right,
each son has committed that sin.
So now they are in a fix as to how to perform these rites so that these souls can be released.
The solution given is that it is only Mother Ganga who will be able to purify and wash away these sins. Just to give a background, Ganga is the daughter of King Himavan, whom we respect today as the Himalayas. And you know, Himavan's son-in-law is Lord Shiva. Because that also happened because he had two daughters, they say. One is Ganga, one is Uma. While he offered Ganga to the heavens, because, you know, it is said that a virtuous woman brings prosperity wherever she sets foot. And symbolic of that, in order to ensure prosperity on earth and in the heavens, it is said that King Himavan offered his daughter Ganga to the heavens and his daughter Uma to the earth as a wife to Lord Shiva, to Rudra. And so now Ganga is in the heavens, and this kind of sin that has been committed by the sons of Sagara requires the river Ganges, the river Ganga, to flow on them. And once this is known, King Sagara starts his penance for Mother Ganga to descend. And Swami writes that till his old age he is unable to achieve it. And with his passing away, Amshumanta becomes the king, becomes the emperor. And Amshumanta tries his best, he grows old, he makes his heir Dilipa as the emperor, and he passes away. Dilipa too tries, and Dilipa also is unable to succeed. Right. And he installs his son Bhagiratha on the throne of Ayodhya, and he passes away. And then comes the hero of our story, that is Bhagiratha.
Right. And Bhagiratha is the one who finally gets the boon. But before we come to that, maybe we'll just take a short break. We've gone through it. We've gone right in the middle of this program. So we'll take a short break. We'll play out a nice bhajan for you, dear listeners. At the end of it, we'll continue the story of how Mother Ganga was brought to the earth.
ಆಶ್ರಯ ಶ್ರೀಧರಾಮ ಜಗದಾಶ್ರಯ ಶ್ರೀಧರಾಮ
ಜಗದಾಶ್ರಯ ಶ್ರೀಧರಾಮ
Welcome back, dear listeners. We are in the middle of the story of Bhagiratha and how he managed to get Mother Ganga down to the earth. As we said, three or four generations of people had tried before that. Before him, his father Dilipa tried. Before Dilipa, it was Amshumanta who tried. Before Amshumanta, it was Sagara, the father of the many sons. He tried. But now, finally, Bhagiratha. And he also was a successful king. He led his kingdom well. But I think everybody in that lineage had this feeling of incompleteness, if not till they achieve this task of bringing down Mother Ganga so that they can release their great-grandfathers from this sin they had got themselves into.
And so Bhagiratha does severe penance. He hands over the kingdom to a proxy who can take care in his absence. And
he also doesn't have children, right?
Yes.
That is also a thing. He is not...
That's why he handed over to a proxy.
Right.
So he doesn't have a children and he gets engaged into penance. And in fact, if we Google for images of Bhagiratha, you will not see a person decked in armor as a king. You will see a person with a long beard and mustache like a sage. Because Bhagiratha is known more as a sage than as a king.
Mm-hmm.
Because that is what he did. He did penance throughout his life. Again, another thing to show that a person becomes a Brahmin and a Kshatriya not by birth, but by the actions and by the aptitude. So, Bhagiratha prays and, you know, the creator, Lord, Brahma, agrees and grants him a boon and tells him that you can indeed get Ganga, Mother Ganga, to earth, but you know, there is one slight problem. As Ganga is a torrential river, a magnificent, huge, as she descends from the heavens onto earth, the earth will not be able to bear the brunt, bear the impact of her fall. And therefore, you should possibly request Lord Shiva to, you know, break the fall so that she enters earth as a gentle stream, as a river in a leisurely flow, not come cascading down and hit the earth. And therefore, while I am ready to ensure that Ganga is sent from heavens to the earth, please pray to Lord Shiva and ensure his blessings that he will receive it properly.
In the suggestion which is given is, of course, that Ganga flows through the locks of Shiva, so that, you know, Shiva takes the main impact of that torrential flow. And then Ganga, as you said, you know, flows as a very gentle and life-giving river in the earth.
And Bhagiratha goes to propitiate Lord Shiva. This is a point where I think, Prem, we should take a little detour, because this is very significant in our dear Swami's life, this incident that happens there. It is said that he is propitiating...
I think that is Sage Bharadwaja.
Oh, yes.
In fact, even I had this very same confusion
when
I was going through it. Where Swami speaks about that paralysis incident which happens.
Okay, the Bhagiratha Bharadwaja confusion.
Right, there is Sage Bharadwaja, who will, incidentally, who will make an appearance in the Ramakatha Raswayani after Rama is banished to the forest.
Okay, so then we will retain the story for that point. Please forgive me, dear listeners, I confused between the two B sages. That is Bharadwaja and Bhagiratha. So anyway, Bhagiratha prays to Lord Shiva and Lord Shiva agrees to bear Mother Ganga. And it is said that he opened up his magnificent locks, matted locks. And as Ganga entered the matted locks of Lord Shiva, he tied them back. And then as a little spring, he allowed her to pop out. And this we can see in many depictions, many paintings of Lord Shiva, that he... is Gangadhari. We sing the bhajan, Juta Jatame Gangadhari. That is what is Lord Shiva. And from his matted locks, you can see one spring jumping out. That is
right.
Mother Ganga. And this the earth is able to bear. And Swami writes that river Ganga, Nalini, enters...
Says, seven streams. It forms seven streams.
Nalini, Plavini.
Akhladini, Nalini, Pavani,
Pavani,
these flow to the east. Subhikshu, Sita and Sindhu flow to the west.
Flow to the west.
And the seven stream follows...
In fact, Sindhu is the river Indus. And right. It is said that the place where Indus flows is Industhan or Hindustan. That is how India gets its name, Hindustan. And Indus is indeed a west-flowing river. I really don't know about Sita, Plavani, don't know the other rivers. But... there are three east flowing, three west flowing, and one stream which follows Bhagiratha as he walks through Ayodhya and his...
going to that place where his the ashes of his great-grandfathers are lying.
Are lying. And that is what we know as Ganga. And in fact, you know, Ganga, where it originates in Dakshin Gangotri.
Mm-hmm.
Dakshin Gangotri, I'm sorry. In Gangotri, that's it. Dakshin Gangotri.
Gangotri
is actually a station in Antarctica. Indian research station. So... Gangotri, which is the place of birth of Mother Ganga.
Right.
And there is this cave called Gaumukh, which is shaped like the mouth of a cow, from where Ganga emerges. There, Ganga is known as Bhagirathi. Bhagirathi literally translates into daughter of Bhagiratha. And because Bhagiratha was responsible for the descent of Ganga, the Ganga there is called Bhagirathi. And just one aside point, you know, the Ganga emerges from these Himalayan snow-capped regions.
Right.
And that place is called Gangotri. where the Indian station is there in Antarctica, it's in the South Pole,
mm-hmm.
it is similar to this region, you know, snow filled and ice. That's why they call it Dakshin Gangotri or the Gangotri of the South.
Right.
That is just making amends for the mistake I committed. Okay, so and that's how Bhagirathi flows and flows over the ashes and redeems. Apart from that, he also wins a boon. You know, Bhagiratha wins a boon that he will have children because he will have progeny who will take care of his lineage
right.
and also his kingdom. And this again, you know, is a metaphor to show the importance of a noble and virtuous soul. A noble and virtuous soul in the family can redeem not only himself, but also his past and the future. That is what happened with Bhagiratha. Not only is Bhagiratha blessed, his ancestors, all those great grandfathers and grandfathers who were burnt to ashes, they were also redeemed. His future also got redeemed because he got the divine assurance and promise that he will have virtuous children who will take care of the kingdom.
And I think his future was more than redeemed because in that very same Ikshvaku clan was born Lord Rama. And even as Vishwamitra was narrating this entire episode, he says that your ancestors are the ones who are responsible for bringing this divine river onto earth. And that's how he narrates this entire story.
And the story is on the banks of River Ganga, as we said. It brings me back to one more practical point, what you were speaking about, how pollution of the Ganga takes place. It is something that we ought to keep in mind and do our best because, you know, we, almost every home has this little sealed pot of Ganga. We call it Ganga Amrit. And in our shrine also, in our altar at home also, there is this little copper pot which is sealed, which is filled with Ganga water. And usually, you know, in every home it is kept because in case of a sudden death, you know, everybody cannot be geographically close to the Ganga. It is this Ganga water that is poured into the mouth of a dying person or a person who has passed away, because it is said that it ensures progress for the soul. Now, when we worship Ganga as such in our altars, is it not a kind of hypocrisy when we left and right and blatantly pollute Mother Ganga? It really pains and that is why it is wonderful that there are talks about cleaning up of the river Ganga. We can only pray and hope and try to contribute our might in whatever way possible so that this river is physical, this river that spiritually cleanses us is kept clean physically.
And even as we are talking about Ganga and how Shiva is called Gangadhari because of accepting the torrential flow on himself before he allowed it to flow on earth.
Mm-hmm.
I'm reminded of a wonderful incident which one of the devotees once shared. You know, he had this desire to do Padapuja for Swami in that very traditional sense. You know, he wanted to do an elaborate Padapuja. So what he would do is, he carried in a bag, you know, a plate with all those things which you need, the kumkum, the haldi,
chandan
and everything, and a small container of Ganga water. So he said that any time when Swami says, okay, you do it now, you should be prepared. So he would always come for darshan with that bag. And many times he had prayed to Swami that, Swami, I want to do. Swami said, I'll give you a chance.
Be the times before the security stepped in.
No, it was quite recently. This devotee had the access to Swami.
Oh, okay. So he could carry it.
So he could carry it around. He was sitting in the portico. So many times he asked and Swami would say that, I'll give you a chance. And as we all would expect it, Swami, I think, called him one day when he was not as prepared as he was on the other occasions. And Swami called him inside the interview room and, you know, he was in such a hurry, pulled out all those things and he was trying to do that. Then finally, when he brought out the small container with Ganga water, Swami looked at him very quizzically and asked, what is that? You know, all these other things are fine, but what is that small container you got? So he said, Swami, this is Ganga water. This is Ganga Jal. I wanted to do, you know, Padapuja with this. And Swami laughed at him. He said, Ganga water, do you want to do Padapuja for me? Swami said, it is in my head. Swami said, it is on my head. So this devotee, he just smiled and, you know, he said, thank you, Swami. It's a revelation, you know, in the sense of Swami is accepting his divinity openly. Then Swami looked at him and said, you don't believe? It is really there. You don't believe, Swami asked. He said, no, Swami, not like that. And Swami bent down and Swami said, touch. And that devotee, you know, one side the chance of touching Swami's hair, but when he felt Swami's hair, he felt that Swami's, he could see that Swami's hair was wet.
Oh.
You know, that there was a dampness in the air, and Swami said, Ganga is there on my head.
Hmm.
You know, there was an experience which he had, and he had come and shared with us.
Wow.
You know, just a small incident, but it's in such small incidents that Swami reveals what he is, right?
Naturally, definitely. And that morning, they get up. I mean, after the story, it's late in the evening when the story is narrated of Ganga, and they take rest on the banks of Ganga. The next day, they had to resume their journey. And Swami writes that when they move ahead, they come across a valley and a beautiful city that is seen at a distance. And Rama again asks, you know, what is the story behind this beautiful city? And Vishwamitra says that it takes quite some time. It appears as if it's close. It's quite far. I'll tell you the story. And thus, he begins to tell the story.
Again, I think he insists that he will tell the story when we reach there. Because he says it's quite a distance and it's going to be by tomorrow evening, by the time we reach there. And once we reach there, I'll tell you the story of that place. And again, emphasizing on being there when you listen to the story or the history of that place.
And reaching there, he tells the story which is famously called as Sagara Manthanam or Samudra Manthan in our Bharatiya culture. The story of the churning of the ocean. Sage Kashyapa had two wives, Diti and Aditi. And Diti is considered as the mother of all the asuras, that is the demons. And Aditi is considered as the mother of all the suras or the devas or the demigods, if we can say so. Now, I'm not going to go into the story of exactly what happened and the details because that's available. But definitely, I would like to go into the beautiful meaning that Swami has given for this whole Sagara Manthanam. If I am not wrong, this is from a discourse that Swami delivered on the 13th of January in 1965. Mm-hmm. Or I don't know if it's 11th or 13th, but January 1965. You know what happened in Sagara Manthanam? Just quickly refreshing it. All the devas and all the danavas, the demons and the demigods, they want to get amrit from the ocean, from the Kshira Sagara. So they get Mount Mandar as the, what do you call that?
The rod, churning rod.
The churning rod. And they use Vasuki the snake as the rope. And the head end of the rope, that is of snake Vasuki, is held by the demons, the asuras. And the tail end is held by the devas. And they churn it. In fact, in the mythology when we read, it goes that the rakshasa, the demons, they say that we are not lowly, we will not hold the tail, we want the head, we want the crest. So they don't realize when they hold, because of the churning process, the snake Vasuki spews out a lot of poison. A poison which starts fuming and it makes the whole waters, the ocean of milk, that is Kshira Sagara, makes it poisonous. And that is why Lord Shiva has to come and take the halahala poison. And that is why, you know, he is called Neelakant, because Parvati comes and holds his throat so that the poison doesn't go into his body. It all remains in his throat and his throat becomes blue. The blue-throated one is Neelakant. And that is what happens. Then, from the churning, as a result of the churning, many things happen. One is Dhanvantari, or the god of health and medicine, comes. The Apsaras come.
Right. In between, after that halahala is spewed out, they find that this mountain which is being used as a churning rod is sinking. Because it doesn't have any base, and even as they're churning it, it sinks. And that is when Lord Vishnu comes and takes the form of a tortoise. The Kurma Avatar is...
That is the story of the Kurma Avatar.
Right. And he becomes the base of that churning rod.
Rod. And he's supporting the Mount Mandar on his back, and the churning is going on. And as the churning goes on, yes, Dhanvantari, as we mentioned. And then Swami says that a kind of juice, rasa, is exuded.
Nectar.
That rasa solidifies and becomes a solid ball which cracks open to give rise to many beautiful maidens and damsels. And since these damsels came from the rasa, they are called as the apsaras. And these are the apsaras. Then... You know, Sura, you know, it is the intoxicating drinks. Intoxicating drinks come And so many things come out. Amrit, or the secret for immortality, is the one that comes last.
Right.
And now this is the story. It has such deep inner meaning.
And I think one of the main things that Swami says is, even in this narration, even in Ramkatha, Swami says that how, be what comes out, whether it's good or bad or pleasant or unpleasant, the asuras and suras are not getting distracted by what comes out. Because they say when you've laid your sight on the amrita,
the ultimate,
you don't stop till that comes. And Swami has many times explained, I think, and that is what Swami told in that discourse also.
Exactly, it is so beautiful. Swami assigns a role to each of these things. Swami says that Mount Mandar, which is the churning rod, is actually your mind.
Mm-hmm.
And now if you look at Swami's discourses many times, that is, Swami says, mind is a key for either liberation or bondage. You turn it right, you get liberation. You turn it wrong, you get bondage. So mind is the churning rod. In the Kshira Sagara, the ocean of milk, Swami says, is nothing but the ocean of Sattvaguna. Sattvaguna is sattvic qualities or virtues. So you have to be virtuous and churn with the mind. And the snake Vasuki, Swami says, are the senses.
Mm-hmm.
The Danavas is the bad, the Devas is the good. Swami says that the senses get pulled by the good one side, get pulled by the bad one side. That is what happens.
Right. They don't have any choice of their own.
Exactly. The senses just get attracted to... Yes. But they are anchored onto the mind. The mind is in the center. One side is good pulling, one side is bad pulling. And the mind will sink unless support comes to you in the form of God's grace, which Swami says is the Kurmavatar. The Kurmavatar is God's grace. That is God's grace because that is God. So God supports your endeavor to churn. And Swami says, poison will come, health issues will come. Krishna also says in the Bhagavad Gita that people approach me for wealth, for health, for wisdom. It is even a jnani. But one who approaches me for me alone attains me. That is what happens when this churning goes on. So many things are achieved. So many things come out, both good and bad. But it is left to us not to get distracted by any of this till the ultimate goal of Amrita. Amrita means immortality. Immortality is achieved only in union with God, becoming one with God. So we have to keep our focus on our goal alone, not get distracted by anything that comes out from the churning of the mind. And then finally, this is another metaphor to show that the mind is just an instrument. It is not a goal in itself. Mm-hmm. The mind is a means to achieve the goal. Once Amrita is got, nobody cares for either the snake or the Mount Mandar. So that this Swami explains beautifully. Unfortunately, we don't have the audio of the discourse in 1965, but it is recorded in Sathya Sai Speaks. I think again, as I said, 13 January, this is what he mentions in the discourse about the inner significance of Sagara Manthanam.
And of course, after this comes the incident of, the Amrita has come out and there is a fight which breaks out between these two asuras and the suras as to who will partake of that nectar first. And that is when another incarnation of Lord Vishnu happens, where Vishnu comes in the form of Mohini. And he kind of hoodwinks, you could say, the demon clan, and then he gives the Amrita to the Devas. And that again is explained in many places as, the Lord comes and says that immortality is not worthy to be given to somebody who is not morally upright, because it will be misused. And that is why he says that it should be given to the pious.
You can never seek to be immortal if you are immoral. That's why Swami says, removal of immoralities is the only way to immortality. And that is what Vishnu also does there. He removes the immorality, that is, the asuras don't get even a drop to drink. In fact, the story goes ahead that one asura secretly comes and drinks, and because of which Vishnu leaves the discus, which cuts him into two parts. One becomes Rahu, one becomes Ketu.
Right.
I mean, that again, it goes into stories. We can keep going because it's never ending. But one thing we have to remember is all this is metaphorical and all this has such powerful message just like the one we now recounted about how removing immorality is the way to immortality. In fact, I remember when I joined MBA, Swami that year almost in almost all his discourses kept emphasizing only on Daiva Preeti, Papa Bhiti, Sanganiti. Means he was saying that Sanganiti, that is morality in society, he used to say that that is the only way out in the world today. If you want to solve the problems of the world, you need Sanganiti. And he would say, in order to have Sanganiti, that is morality in society, you need Papa Bhiti, that is fear of sin. And in order to have fear of sin, you need Daiva Preeti, love for God. And so, Swami would say that you start off your journey by having love for God. That, you know, it was so beautiful because that connects and shows how the way to solve the problems in the world today is via loving God. You start loving God and you see problems in the society disappearing because Daiva Preeti leads to Papa Bhiti. Papa Bhiti leads to Sanganiti. Sanganiti solves the problems in the society.
And I think it's a smooth progression into the next story which comes, which is a very, very important story and a story which is very significant in the entire Ramayana itself. When they move forward and they come to another hermitage or an abandoned hermitage, which Vishwamitra explains is the erstwhile ashrama of the
Gautama.
And goes on to explain how Gautama had a very, very beautiful wife and her name was Ahalya. And when Gautama was once away, Lord Indra comes in the form of Gautama and, you know, makes Ahalya believe that it is her lord. And then at that time, Gautama returns and finds that his wife has been disloyal to him. And that is when he curses her and says that you shall become a rock. And that's how the story goes. But then he realizes that it's no fault of hers. You know, it's just been a trick which has been played on her. So he says, but I've cursed you, I cannot take it back. And then he says that many, many years later, the son of Dashrata, Lord Rama, who is nobody other than the incarnation of Vishnu, he will come and when his feet touches you, you will be revived. And then I will also come back and I will accept you.
It's strange, right, that this Indra causes so much havoc and nobody seems to be cursing him. But you know, it again goes on to show how, this is from the point of view of Ahalya, that when you are faultless, see, I feel these stories, they keep highlighting something. See, when you hear this story, you feel it's so unfair for Ahalya. She has been loyal to Gautama all her life. And here she doesn't even know that it's Indra. She just felt it is Gautama and treated him like Gautama. And she's being cursed. I feel stories like this exist in our scriptures just to show that sometimes life is not apparently fair at every single point in time. That's why that song is there, right? When life seems so unfair and no one seems to care, say his name, see his form, hold on. You know, yeah, life will be unfair at times. But the magical thing is, Swami says, dharmo rakshati rakshita. If you have been true and good, your goodness and truth will protect you. That is what happened because a curse for Ahalya turned out to be a boon. You know what was Ahalya's curse? A curse on Ahalya was that you will get an opportunity to take Rama's Pad Namaskar. Ah, how I would love to have such a curse. I curse you, Arvind, that you will not enjoy anything in life till the day comes when you will get Swami's Pad Namaskar. Wow. Isn't that a curse that we would love to have, Prem? And that shows that though life is unfair, your goodness definitely comes to protect you. Unfairly you might have got a curse, but since you have been good and dharmic, the curse in itself becomes a blessing.
And interestingly, you know, that's what Swami explains, that she doesn't turn or transform into a stone as most stories tell us. Swami says that the curse which Gautama actually gives her is, you shall be inactive and inanimate. You will sit here and repent for this mistake you have done till the point when the Lord comes and redeems you.
So it is almost just a like camouflaged penance.
It's like she is in penance. She cannot break that penance till she gets that boon. That's almost the so-called curse that she gets. But I think we'll just listen to that description which Swami gives about how this whole episode happened, I think in the year 1996, 21st of May when Swami is talking about the Ramayana, entire Samukos was on Ramayana, the place where Swami speaks about how Ahalya was redeemed, and Swami gives a very beautiful inner significance even of that, and we listen to that.
పోతు ఉన్నారు రామలక్ష్మణులు.
రామ లక్ష్మణ్ అవర్ ప్రొసీడింగ్.
విశ్వామిత్రుడు ఆయా అరణ్యమును గురించి చక్కగా వివరిస్తూ వస్తున్నాడు.
విశ్వామిత్ర స్టార్టెడ్ నరేటింగ్ ది డీటెయిల్స్ ఆఫ్ ద ఫారెస్ట్.
ఇక్కడ వామనమూర్తి పుట్టినటువంటి దినం.
This is the place where Vamana was born.
ఈ వామనమూర్తి తిరిగినటువంటి ప్రదేశము.
This is the place where Vamana was born.
ఈ విధంగా సాక్షాత్ నారాయణమూర్తిని గురించి విశ్వామిత్రుడు చెప్తూ వచ్చాడు.
విశ్వామిత్ర స్టార్టెడ్ టెలింగ్ అబౌట్ నారాయణ గాడ్ హింసెల్ఫ్.
ఈ విధంగా చెప్పుతూ చెప్పుతూ చెప్పుతూ
while telling like that
Gautama Maharshi ashramam cherukunnadu.
They reached Gautama hermitage
anaga akkada ahalya shapamu
jarigindi. Ahalya shapa
anaga shapam ante emti mana puranaal lopala ana raayiga mari poyindi anukuntunnaru.
We say that Ahalya has given a curse that she should be a stone.
Raayiga kanipistundadi kani ana sajeevigaane untundadi.
Though she appears to be a stone but she's alive.
Shapam rahasyam.
It is their secret there.
Aa dummu cheta matti cheta inni samvatsaramlo aa vidhanga ఒకే స్థానంలో ఉండటం చేత అది రాయిగా కనిపిస్తూ వచ్చింది.
బికాస్ షీ రిమైండ్ ఆల్ ద టైమ్ ఎట్ వన్ స్పాట్ బికాస్ ద డస్ట్ అరౌండ్ షీ లుక్ లైక్ ఎ స్టోన్.
కానీ సర్వజ్ఞుడైన రామునకు ఈ ఎంత తెలుసును.
బట్ రామ హూజ్ ఆల్ నోయింగ్ నౌ దిస్ ఫ్యాక్ట్.
అన్నీ తెలిసి కూడాను ఏమీ తెలియనట్టుగా నటిస్తూ వచ్చాడు.
దో హీ నోస్ ఎవ్రీథింగ్ హీ స్టార్టెడ్ ప్రిటెండింగ్ యాజ్ ఇఫ్ హీ డస్ నాట్ నో.
అక్కడికి వెళ్లేటప్పటికి లక్ష్మణ కొంత విశ్రాంతి తీసుకోవటం మంచిది అన్నాడు రాముడు.
By the time they reached there, he said, Lakshmana, let us take rest for some time.
Vishwamitra kodnu angikarinchadu.
Vishwamitra also accepted this proposal.
Daggariki pothu unnadu.
They were approaching this stone.
Inka padam kudanu sokaledu.
He did not step over there.
Ee padam yokka vibration dani yokka prabhavam inka raati daggariki pothundadi.
The vibrations of the lotus feet were approaching the
stone. Tatchaname kadilindi Ahalya.
Immediately there was movement.
Padamulu gattiga pattukundi.
And she caught hold of the feet.
రాముడు ఆశ్చర్యపడినట్టుగా నటిస్తున్నాడు.
రామ వాస్ ప్రిటెండింగ్ యాజ్ ఇఫ్ హి వాస్
రాముడు తెలుసును.
రామ నో
ఈ మహల్యాన్ని తెలుసును.
షీ నోస్.
కానీ తాను మానవుడిగా సంచరించాలి.
బట్ హి హస్ టు మూవ్ లైక్ ఎ హ్యూమన్.
నేను దైవంగా సంచరించకూడదు.
ఐ షుడ్ నాట్ లుక్ లైక్
గాడ్. అనేటువంటి సంకల్పాన్ని తాను దృఢం చేసుకున్నాడు.
హి హాడ్ ద స్ట్రాంగ్ డిటర్మినేషన్.
వేదవేద్యే పరే పుంసే జాతే దశరథాత్మజే. నేను దశరథుని కుమారుణ్ణి అంటున్నాడే కానీ నేను శ్రీరామచంద్రుణ్ణి, నేను మహావిష్ణు స్వరూపుణ్ణి ఎక్కడ కూడా చెప్పడం లేదు.
హి ఆల్వేస్ సెడ్ దట్ ఐఎమ్ సన్ ఆఫ్ దశరథ. హి నెవర్ సెడ్ ఐఎమ్ శ్రీమన్నారాయణ. హి నెవర్ సెడ్ దట్ ఐఎమ్ శ్రీరామచంద్ర.
భగవంతుడు అనేటువంటిది ఒక ఋషులకు మాత్రం తప్ప ఎవరికీ తెలియదు.
ఓన్లీ సేజెస్ నో దిస్ దట్ హీస్ గాడ్, నో వన్ ఎల్స్.
లక్ష్మణికి రామునికి కూడా తెలుసును.
లక్ష్మణ రామ నో దిస్ ఫ్యాక్ట్.
కానీ ఇప్పుడు దీనిని ఏమాత్రము బహిరంగ పరచకూడదు.
బట్ దిస్ షుడ్ నాట్ బి నోన్ టు అదర్స్.
వచ్చిన కార్యం జరిగేంత వరకు కూడాను ఈ రహస్యాన్ని అట్టే దాచుకోవాలి.
అంటిల్ ద టాస్క్ ఈస్ ఫుల్ఫిల్డ్ దిస్ హస్ టు బి సీక్రెట్ హస్ టు బి మెయింటైన్డ్.
తాను ఎందుకోసం వచ్చాడు?
వై డిడ్ హి కమ్?
సాధు సంరక్షణార్థమై వచ్చాడు.
టు ప్రొటెక్ట్ ద పాయస్.
సాధువులు అంటే ఎవరు?
ఆర్ పాయస్.
సన్యాసి వేషం వేసుకున్నటువంటి వాళ్ళ సాధువులు.
యు మీన్
సాధు మానవుని ఎందున్నటువంటి సాధుత్వం అనేటువంటి దాన్ని సంరక్షించే కోసం.
To protect that pious quality within man.
Anduvalli paritranaya sadhunam annadu.
So he said that you would protect the pious people.
Andari endukodunu sadhutvam untundadi.
There is that pious quality in all.
Aa sadhutvam appudu appudu vidrumminchi
sometimes it will
krutanga vahinchi
sometimes it perverts
manavatvanni maripimpa chestundi
and it turns into cruelty and makes you forget the human quality.
Kanigane manavatvanni jnaptiki cheppinche nimittamai
to make to remind the human quality
samarinchi sadhutvanni samrakshistu vastuntadu.
Therefore to remind the human quality the pious nature has to be protected.
Ee naa kartavyamu.
This is my duty
ani ramulu cheptu vachadu.
Rama started telling that way.
Ee lopala ahalya aneka vidhamuluga kodana paritapam pondutu tannu chaminchamani tannu anugrahinchamani ప్రార్థిస్తూ వచ్చింది.
ఇన్ ద మీన్ టైమ్ అహల్య స్టార్టెడ్ రిపెంటింగ్. షీ ప్రేడ్ ఫర్ పార్డన్ అండ్ ఫర్ గ్రేస్.
ఆ సమయానికి తపస్సునికై ఏగినటువంటి యొక్క గౌతమ మహర్షి కూడాను ప్రతించితే ప్రజెంట్ అయ్యాడు.
ఇన్ ద మెయిన్ టైమ్ గౌతమ సేజ్ కేమ్ దేర్.
చూచాడు.
ఈ సా
గౌతమునికి తెలుసు శ్రీరామచంద్రుడు నారాయణమూర్తి అని.
గౌతమ నోస్ రామ ఇస్ నారాయణ గాడ్.
స్వామి
స్వామి
నిమిత్త మాత్రం భవసరి సాచి అన్నట్టుగా నిమిత్త మాత్రంగా ఏదో ఒకటి జరగాలి.
సంథింగ్ షుడ్ హ్యాపెన్ యాజ్ ఎ ప్లీ.
కారణం లేని కార్యం జరగదు.
Without cause there cannot be a
విత్తనం లేని మొక్క మలవదు.
Without seed there cannot be tree.
కనుకనే ఇవన్నీ కూడా మంచికే జరుగుతుంటాయి.
So all things happen for our good.
ఏది జరిగినా మన మంచి కోసమనే.
Whatever might happen is for our own good.
ఈ సత్యాన్ని ప్రపంచానికి చాటుతూ వచ్చాడు.
This truth is taught to the world.
రాములు సర్వము తెలిసినప్పటికీ ఏమీ తెలియనటువంటి మానవునిగా సంచరిస్తూ వచ్చాడు.
దో రామా ఇస్ ఆల్ నోయింగ్ హి ప్రిటెండెడ్ యాజ్ ఇఫ్ హి డజంట్ నో.
అక్కడ గౌతముని కూడా చేర్చుకొని మిథిలాపురానికి చేరారు.
So that was the description which Swami gave. And you know, the beautiful thing, why this episode is so significant in the Ramayana is, Swami says that this is the first episode where Rama actually reveals his divinity. You know, all through, he is only coming out as a very brilliant human being.
And a great warrior.
Great warrior. But this was the first time he was saying that he is more than human. And even in that, he tried his best to convince everybody that he was just a human, just a prince, son of Dashrath, as Swami was saying. But you know, very beautifully Swami is saying that this is the very purpose for which God comes, to foster that goodness which is in each person. That not the sadhus among men and women, but sadhutvam, or that goodness which is in each one.
I think, Prema, there is no better message than this that to conclude our satsang with. Swami so beautifully says that whatever happens is for the good, and the Lord is always there to sustain any goodness, and that should be the motivation and inspiration for us to be good, because we will be sustained and fostered by the Lord. We would like to bring this satsang to a close, as always offering our gratitude and prayerful prostrations at the lotus feet of our dear Swami, and our pranams to Hanuman, who is Lord Hanuman, who is ever present wherever the glory of Lord Sri Rama is sung. He is ever present there, inspiring us so that we can aspire to become a devotee like him. With this, we will now play a bhajan, the other side of...
Yes, Arvind, instead of a bhajan, what we are going to play is something very interesting. Uh-huh. Tomorrow is the 68th Indian independence. So,
okay.
Dear listeners, to celebrate that, we have our... experts in the audio section. We have Brother Anirudh, our music composer. They have come up with a beautiful track which is going to celebrate this wonderful event for all of us. And interestingly, they've taken that Padyam which Swami sings,
Kanda Kandantara, okay,
and made a wonderful song. And more interestingly, it's been made into a very refreshing video.
Exactly, which will be played on our website. Right,
which will be on our website very shortly, dear listeners. So
don't miss it. It's awesome. I saw it, Prem. I mean, it is so beautiful. It arouses you in... arouses in you feelings of devotion, love and patriotism. And more than anything else, you know, though Swami is not, I'm giving away a little bit here, though Swami is not seen in the middle of the video anywhere, throughout, you can't help but feel Swami throughout, because, you know, coincidentally, the Indian flag too has the orange and the white that we most commonly see all around in Prashanthi Nilayam. So beautiful it is. Definitely do watch out for the video, dear listeners.
So we're going to leave you with this song, dear listeners, and you'll be joined by Chandu at the end of the song. And once again, don't forget to catch this video on our website, which will be up very shortly.
మహనీయులను గన్న మాతృభూమి పాశ్చాత్య వీరుల పారద్రోలించియు స్వాతంత్రమును గన సమర భూమి పాండిత్య గుణ చాల ఖ్యాతిగాంచిన ప్రతిభ చూపించిన భరత భూమి సంగీత సాహిత్య శాస్త్రీయ విద్యలందు శక్తి చూపిన దివ్య భూమి చిత్రకళలతోడ చిత్రమయ్యున్నట్టి భరత భూమి అందు జననముంది భరత మాత ధర్మ భాగ్యంబు కాపాడ బాధ్యతంతయు వీరే పాలులారా బాధ్యతంతయు వీరే పాలులారా Thank you.
She dazzles with the beauty of purity. She shines with the virtue of sacrifice. She roars with the power of truth. She glows with the aura of love. Let us salute this glorious Mother India.